Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
It's a little special day. We like to call Fascism Friday.
A special day.
Puts a little pep in your step. Talking about the big F. Good morning, Kathleen, and everyone else who's watching but not commenting. Yeah. I hear from people all the time that, hey, I watched this, but they don't comment. So there's lurkers.
There are many lurkers, which is cool. That's great.
Hiding in the shadows, waiting for their time.
That's right.
But this is episode 192 of Transmission. We're talking about change this week. And, you know, we always try to connect it with fascism when it comes to Fridays.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. Mm-hmm. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
And I'm Mark Van Steenhoek. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination. You know, those two names of MICA and CPI, if I think back to being rural Minnesotan conservative, those are both bullshitty names. You know what I mean? They seem fancy.
Yeah.
It's fancy and got words in them that are like
imagine. Although, you know, what I try to always say to people is, well, MICA, like the book in the Bible. And it's amazing how many people who are church-going people look at me like, that's a book in the Bible? So often, I've been surprised at how many times that has not worked.
It's a minor prophets. You know. It's a
very, very small book in the Bible.
Better than having an organization called Habakkuk.
That would be a really long acronym. You'd really have to. That would talk about being a bullshitty name. It would be a mouthful.
I mean,
try. We should give prizes. Anybody that can come up with a good acronym out of Habakkuk gets a prize.
And since you're on the board of CPI, I mean, we could suggest a name change from CPI to Habakkuk.
For those of you that don't know, Mark loves to change names of things.
Naming in general, and sometimes the spirit or quality of something changes and you want to change the name.
Yeah.
Anyways, we're far afield at this point.
We're far afield. So change and Fascism Friday, the thing I was thinking about, probably started thinking about it yesterday, but then this morning, as we were building up steam to get to the broadcast, was just how, in many ways, fascism arises as a refusal to change, mm-hmm. right? Or as a real attempt to block change. So there's some kind of change that's needed in society or that's coming or that, you know, would be good if it happened for the majority of people. But then there's a dominant class that somehow doesn't want that change to happen. Mm-hmm. And so the great response to that is fascism and as a way of digging in and controlling.
There's some sneakiness in there too, because, you know, resistance to change, you could call that conservatism. Okay. So what makes it fascism? Well, they might be very similar in my mind, but fascists will then attempt to appeal to a mythic past or a mythic core that is being threatened and then try to insist upon that. So it's kind of like the way evangelicalism, fundamentalism arose, claiming some sort of fundamentals to the faith that have never been fundamentals before. So it's like creating this new fiction or this new narrative. It's an innovation under the disguise of a return to a glorious past, and then to force that on people, you know, and those who resisted are your enemies. Like that's where it becomes very violent and innovative, mm-hmm. at the same time. Like Trump is an innovation but disguising as a return to the glorious past.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, what's going on right now in our country, I mean, many people have noted the fact that, you know, the GOP has basically become the white party and has shown, you know, zero either interest or ability to support policies that go beyond whiteness. And so the only way that they can win into the future is by, you know, by suppressing the non-white vote, right? And so now you've got, you know, these hundreds of bills in state legislatures all across the country that are basically voter suppression bills. And what this is a major resistance to the very clear demographic change that is happening in this country that everybody knows is happening, right? I mean, the folks in the GOP aren't ignorant about this or in denial about it. And their response is simply to become more fascist.
Right? And, you know, there's a subtlety to it because, I mean, the people I knew who would have been Bush conservatives became Trump conservatives, and they think they were the same the whole time. And maybe in some ways they were, maybe their deep thoughts were the same, but there's this slow transition because the threat is growing.
Mm-hmm.
The perceived threat is growing. And so in their mind, they're just doubling down and aren't aware of the fact that they've mutated into this other political way of being that is increasingly mm-hmm. hostile.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So a few comments coming in already, which is great.
So he agrees with the acronym. What's the prize, Dan?
I don't know. Maybe a selfie with Bubo.
I mean, that'll be harder to pull off.
Well, we could do it virtually.
A
virtual selfie with Bubo. Or maybe like a little framed portrait of Bubo.
Oh, that'd be sweet.
Wouldn't that be nice?
That's a good prize. I like that.
Yeah.
Susan writes, the Bible doesn't change, people do. Direct quote this week by a fundy evangelical upset about sex, marriage, and childbirth shifts in the younger generation. A lot of this resistance to change in these folks who claim a lot of political power, unfortunately. Oh my God, we could just talk about how people read and use the Bible that way.
Yeah, so that's a great example, Mark, of what you were just talking about, right? Mm-hmm. So we cast the Bible in a certain way, right? And we say, oh, this is unchanging truth. This is, you know, God's truth beamed down from on high. Your voice has to keep getting deeper and deeper as you're talking about that. And the evil, right? The evil is how sinful humans want to change what is true, right? So we have horrible, you know, moral relativism, and we have, you know, syncretism, and all of these awful things. And if only, you know, people would promote the highly polygamous, slave-driven family values of the Bible. Oh, I mean the single family heterosexual marriage in the Bible, everything would be fine, right? Everything would be fine. And again, the construction of that, right? Mm-hmm. That initial sentence, is simply a mythology.
Yeah. It just takes so much, so much perspective in order to like the idea that there's somehow the nuclear family existed in the Bible at all. is
well,
bizarre
you have to
as
not,
hell.
You have to not read the Bible, basically, to believe that.
Yeah. So much. Or the idea that somehow there's change of perspective within the Bible. Like, it gets interesting real fast.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Ceres writes, fascism is really a refusal of change, a change to shedding things that don't nourish well-being and transformation. It is never about honoring continuity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or it is about honoring continuity for the privileged few, right? I mean, the you know, and this to me is relates to another thing that I've been thinking about, which is about you know, something that I hear from a lot of white folks recently, which is, you know, all of this upheaval is so tiring and exhausting, and I just want to go back to my nice regular life. And I just want to sort of check out. And of course, they don't say this, but the parenthetical after that is, and I have the privilege to do that. Right. And so that the conformity that fascism tries to honor is the conformity of the privileged class and continuity. And, you know, I mean, how many, and, you know, in church circles, in white church circles, you hear this 10 times a week, right? I mean, how many people are like, if only we could go back to the 50s when everything was just great.
There were some great things about the 50s, like the marginal tax rate being one of them, but it's amazing how what things get included in this appeal to the mythic past.
Yeah.
Oof. Well, and that's part of the thing is this is fascism is, and we were talking this beforehand, fascism is a toxic remedy for a misdiagnosed problem. But there are some parts of the diagnosis that have a little bit of accuracy. So the idea is, you know, and this is where it gets dicey when you start talking about the disillusioned rural white person who is the favorite scapegoat of the Democratic Party. But they have reasons to be grumpy, you know. But if you start talking about that there's actual reasons for frustration, it just sounds like you're defending whiteness. Like that's kind of where some of the discourse has kind of collapsed down into that sort of way of thinking. And that's not only is it unfair to people, but even more problematic in my mind is it leads to bad tactical responses. So what do you do about the fact that, you know, the most sparsely populated areas have more power proportionally and are populated with conservatives who are driven by a sort of resentment? And some of that change they've experienced in small town Americana land, it's some of the frustrations is legitimate. Like they have, you know, there's no small farmers really anymore in large scale. Small towns have dried up. And so you have downtowns that are basically shuttered and only some bars remain. Right. They are don't get the infrastructure that they need. So internet is slow, things like that. And here comes a fascist saying, you know what? Immigrants, am I right? And they start kind of like saying, look at all the resources that are going to undocumented people. It's a cash cow. And, you know, there's voter, like, and they start naming this narrative of why power, they have less power than they think they should have, or at least the ability to have the life that was promised to them after World War II. Yeah. So they have, but then they get the wrong analysis. They have the wrong way of fixing it. And then this resentment of theirs, some of which is valid, gets weaponized to against people of color, against immigrants, against all the enemies.
Yeah. Of conservative. And so the, you know, and I was mentioning that before we started that Ektem Okuren in this great book about how to lose a country, you know, it talks about the fact that fascism often arises from the rural areas, right? Like it starts out there. And so the, you know, what happens is that as power gets concentrated in an empire, oftentimes fewer resources go to the hinterland, right? And then there's resentment and anger and loss and grief that builds up out there, which then as people want to change things in the center of power because there's all this oppression and injustice, those in power can reach out to the hinterland and co-opt those folks and kind of bring them in. She talks about, you know, in Turkey that she saw this, like the people from, you know, the fascist party started out as these rural folks that Erdogan was cultivating. And then over the years, and she talks about a few specific examples, like these store owners, you know, that ended up in his inner circle and cabinet in Istanbul, right? They get brought in, having been nurtured in this fascist ideology, to attempt to suppress the democratic changes that people in the urban areas, who've also abandoned the rural areas, want to make happen.
I'm thinking about, the tactics. So it makes sense that progressive and leftist organizing happens in cities. We get stuck in thinking that the rural places have always been super conservative and regressive, which isn't exactly true at all.
Which is not true.
And to me, it's interesting, like looking at Jesus, he started as a rural organizer and then moved in. And there's even people making fun of like, he's from Hicksville, like, and he's gathering Hicksville people. Yeah. And then they slowly made their way into the big city, and a movement was born that way. And so there's some wisdom there. Like the reason why I worked then and why it's important to think about now is there is this real sense that people in rural areas get less resources. You know, there's some reasons for being frustrated, but it gets very complicated by how racism has been used as and part of that. Other comments here. Ellen writes, I don't think it's a mistake that Noam Chomsky is a linguist and a leftist. A big thing is language changes, and we describe how rather than trying to stop the change.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, language is obviously a very big part of the issue around change, right? And so how we use words, how we construct narratives and stories. So I actually just posted what was a great, insightful reflection about this earlier this morning about, this whole narrative around, this cop who shot Dante Wright, and this narrative of an accident, right? And I'd encourage you to go on my Facebook page and read it, because it's actually really brilliant. And what he's advocating for is that when she was screaming taser, taser, she was actually not talking about her taser. She was trying to get the cop that was dealing with him to use his taser. And that she knew she had her gun drawn the whole time. And then she shot him. And so immediately, though, we craft, she crafted this narrative of, oh, this is an accident. And then that gets put forward by the chief of police. And then people look at the video with this idea in mind and make this different connection and say, oh, yeah, this was an accident. Right. When in fact, it may have not been the kind of accident that we're thinking about at all. Our language very much shapes how we view change, what kinds of changes we think are possible and important, and what kinds of changes we try to avoid.
Well, and even everything having to do with PC or woke, that kind of resistance is somehow this belief that language is solidified around authoritative ultimate truths. And then once you start changing the language, it's your attempt to revise history and do all these other things. And it's a type of tyranny, which is always funny. Like if you try to tell someone like, well, the idea that we translate as homosexuality from the Bible, that's a relatively recent innovation. They're like, nope. People have been hating literal homosexuals this whole time. There's been this clear, concise definition of homosexuality that's existed from all times and all places, and God's against it. Like that kind of. Ed writes, we need to talk about corporate America's role, limiting the discussion to matters of race while ignoring its role in creating poverty. I mean, that's part of it. Is this? I don't like when people just make a blanket criticism of identity politics as though it's all a bad thing. But I think what oftentimes when people do that, what they mean is this sort of focusing in on one area of oppression and bracketing out others, and then doing hierarchical sort of things. So then all of a sudden, Amazon having a statement about Black Lives Matter, we treat that as though it's meaningful, more meaningful than maybe it is, because we're looking at it. They're choosing how they want to deal with race, and they're doing it in a way that's very non-material, that doesn't deal with the complexities and intersections of mm-hmm. oppression.
Yeah.
And so then we can't have meaningful conversations about the fact that there are poor white people who experience oppression, because we want to only look at it through one narrow way of seeing things. It doesn't even show the whole picture about race at all.
Yeah, and then also, you know, it also can flip all kinds of other ways. So, for example, where corporate America might want to focus, you know, conversation on some other cool in topic, while ignoring the fact that, you know, when Monsanto takes out a copyright on a life form and then limits what people can grow in rural areas, like, maybe that's a problem for how the economics of rural areas go. They don't want anybody talking about that, right? Mm-hmm. So
Gus writes, there's a great video that Vox made a couple of years ago on the ways voter suppression has been the tactic among white folks dating back to Reconstruction. And Reconstruction still looms large over all the stuff we're talking about. Even has an appearance of the white folks who found their spines until things get hard.
All right. Then he's got a link to that.
Yep. And if you can't see the link, maybe just Google Vox and voter suppression. That might show up. Ed says, they feel aggrieved and their anger is misdirected by politicians and Fox at immigrants. Yeah, and I was telling Dan this, like, where I grew up, the resentments tended to be towards Native Americans. And then some immigrants, as some of the jobs in the area, like the turkey plant and Pelican Rapids and stuff would getting immigrants, right? And so the narrative I had, like, I didn't see myself as supremacist even a little. What I saw is people that I thought of as my peers, because I went to school with kids who were Native American and were kind of economic bottom of the barrel people. So we were all the same in my mind, but they got some perks that I didn't get. And what makes them better than me? They're entitled and they're cheating the system, and it's unfair, and we need to take from them. Because I didn't have an analysis that included the history of colonization, understood power and privilege at all. And so I had resentment. Now, the resentment that I had was kind of real. Like, I should be frustrated that I couldn't afford college and things. I should be frustrated about that. Now, it became toxic because all of a sudden, somewhere the narrative is, but look at over there.
There's somebody to blame.
If you're a Native American, they're the same as you, really. And they can go to college for free and they get some dividends if they have a casino and they can fish times when you can't fish. Fuck them. Mm-hmm. They're the problem. So this massive redirection. And so if someone comes along and says, well, I don't care what rural people think, they're racist. It's like, well, there's some truth to that. But the truth is, like, pragmatically speaking, anyways, we need to figure out a way to change the direction of their resentment and not just try to sweep it away, because that's only going to make it worse.
Yeah. And that, you know, and Susan's next comment gets this. I mean, the divide and conquer strategy is the classic fascist strategy. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the origin of whiteness in general, right? The creation of the class of white people to then justify black slavery. Machiavelli wrote about divide and conquer. I mean, this is a very well-known right-wing strategy, is because you get people pissed off enough and then they're willing to fight for you and maintain your power.
Yeah. Susan writes, misplaced outrage pitting poor whites against black and brown people is not new. I get mad and sad at how little that has changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Ed writes, liberal media mostly just talk about voting rights and how bad the right is rather than economic justice. Yeah, there's, you know, and there's reasons for that. There's reasons why politicians don't really talk a lot about economic justice in a way that is more than kind of based on some sort of pity. Like, we need to have welfare programs for struggling people, like, is the way it might be pitched at all, rather than any sort of deeper analysis. And that class in capitalist analysis, really without that, everything else we talk about, including racism, gets skewed and is treated like, falls into a morality bucket is what it does. Is then racism is this internalized moral problem. And so if we could educate those people to be less racist, they would be less racist. And in fact, it's because it's lack of education, we can say that rural people are dumb, because if they were smart, they wouldn't think this way. Like, that's how it all is pitched. Instead of having any sort of systemic analysis that would require us to talk about the economics in a deeper way. And, you know, you can't do that because all the news is owned by like four people. That's right. Yeah. And politicians are owned by about four people.
Four people, right? Them too.
Yeah. Maria writes, the immigrants are the lowest class in the rural areas and they have almost no power representation. Oh my God, that's so true.
And that's very, very true. And you see that everywhere. And and we could do a whole thing on how some of the structural legal ways that's baked in, but it's incredibly vicious. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of this profound toxic, I don't know if the word irony is good, but, you know, so these white people in rural America who feel under siege by immigrants, I mean, this is not a new thing by any means at all. Meanwhile, those immigrants are some of the most disempowered people in our country, rather than, even if they're, you know, they're fully documented or even citizens naturalized, they still don't have much power because white people aren't giving it to them because they feel like they don't have any power and it's being taken away. Mm-hmm. Rex writes, but those small town folks voted for the policies that created their problems. Yeah.
To some extent, but the other thing is that they also voted for politicians who then ignored them and who then were working for the companies that created their problems. So, you know, and I've seen that very clearly. I mean, I've now lived in rural and urban areas pretty much 50-50 my whole life. And, I've seen that very, very clearly. And some of the shift, I mean, you know, just taking Northwest Minnesota as an example. I mean, Northwest Minnesota used to be Democrat, a solidly Democrat, the DFL, you know, the Democratic Farm and Labor Party. And they sent Democrats to Washington. They sent Democrats to St. Paul. They sent, and those folks that they sent consistently, worked for policies that have not helped this area. This again is part of this general abandonment that happens as empire builds. And, you know, I mean, a lot of what happened to Jesus can be seen through this lens too. I mean, as power concentrated in Rome and in the states, city states around Rome, there was less and less that went to the hinterlands that was positive in any way. It became more and more extractive, more and more just siphoning taxes and money back to Rome. And that creates discontent. And so it's, and from a left point of view, the abandonment of rural America has been a political disaster. But it's a very common thing that happens in extractive economies.
Yeah. So if they voted for things that ultimately hurt them and it hurts other people too, I think it's fair to be upset at Trump supporters in rural America. Like, I'm not trying to defend. But at the same time, it's like, well, I want everyone to do well in our society. And tactically, the way we get there, we're going to have to rethink the sort of like pitting, naming of rural poor white people as a stereotypical bad guy. And, you know, if you have a little analysis and say, look, let's focus more on the rich white people. I mean, it raises this question, and this we're pretty much out of time, so we're not going to be able to get into
well,
this.
But I want to really say something about this question series, because, so how do we create alliances between the urban poor and the rural poor? And this is something that I've been interested in for decades now, mm-hmm. and I've talked about this at conferences. I've talked about this within seminary education. I mean, the similarities between the urban poor and the rural poor are incredible. And, you know, they don't look the same. You think that it's really different, but it's actually incredibly similar. And I know that actually Gregory, who's, you know, been on the show, has commented, is doing some really interesting work in Alabama, connection with some rural white organizers, and you know, some of the work that he's doing in Huntsville. And to me, this is actually an incredibly fertile ground for organizing, but it takes a lot of work. There's some real structural impediments. The fact that there's not good internet in rural areas is a real part of the problem. But there's so much in common. And I wish that there was more that was being done about this, because I think it's really important.
Well, and there's also like, I mean, the nonprofit reality of like a lot of activism is still like is hitched on to nonprofit systems that require donor base. And you have a concentration of available donors in urban contexts that you don't have in rural contexts. So there's a critical mass issue there, and mm-hmm. people in the cities are not like lining up to fund rural outreach.
Nope.
And it's not like those organizers in rural areas can then get a part-time job that pays enough for them to spend the other part of their time doing. It's the same reason that rural past, like it's hard to be a pastor in rural areas, because then you have to take in a few, you know, congregations that are dwindling. It's the same kind of thing. Marlene says, can you include the link to the article you mentioned, Dan?
Yeah, Marlene, it wasn't an article. It was a Facebook post that I shared. So if you just go on my Facebook feed and scroll down a post or two, you'll find it.
Gus writes, again, this is, you keep bringing this up, and I keep like putting off watching this show because it was canceled early. But regarding rural radicals, Kansas had a strong communist organizing contingent back in the 20s and 30s. The show Damnation on Netflix, and amazing, by the way, is based loosely on a real farmers union and strike in Iowa.
Yeah, and it is an amazing show. So I watched it on Gus's recommendation, and it's super good.
Kathleen writes, Amazon scared the workers into not unionizing, threats of losing their jobs.
Yep.
Susan writes, education is so important beyond the propaganda taught in public school curriculum. Once you know and understand, it's much harder to hate blindly. I mean, it's definitely a huge piece of it. And good formation requires a good education in the mix.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a big starting point. Sarah's writes.
Wait a minute, Mark. You always pass over the compliment comments.
Yeah, no.
You passed over the one earlier.
Okay.
I really appreciate all the compliments that we get. That's awesome.
Fair enough. You got to marinate in the.
You skipped over Ron's earlier. Yeah.
Well, thank you for the compliments.
Yeah, we really appreciate them.
Series writes, and how do we connect class analysis and colonialism? You're asking the big, chewy questions.
The big questions.
Poor and urban white folks don't realize they're being manipulated and complicit in other rural people's suffering in the global South. Totally true. There's so much there.
And that's one that really is off people's radar.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, very good.
Neil says, I grew up on a farm, Central Texas rural community. The division of rural urban troubles me deeply. I left to go to college and have a wider perspective, perhaps. But when I hear rural people in the media talk about things that aren't xenophobic, I see people I grew up with and I hear their pains. I've yet to find a way to bridge between where I come from and my current urban life, though. I feel that.
Well, it's challenging.
CK writes, in all of this, one of the things is the male ego of supremacy, historically. Yep.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. That's another part of a thread in that. Ellen writes, but Dan, if your rural area sends a politician who will remember them, that politician might support abortion. That's part of the strategy, this moral kind of weird, moral conservatism.
Yeah.
Jeff writes, we live in a time of cell phones and bots and algorithms are an important piece of the psychological warfare, creating self-reinforcing realities, grounded in many cases in fear, misinformation, demonization, et cetera. Huge issues here. For sure. There's definitely this gross echo chamber effect that we're seeing intensify. Merlene says, and we cannot leave out of this conversation the propaganda of the Christian right in rural America. Mm-hmm. For the last 40 years now, particularly on FM radio before Fox, that was part of my conservatization into sliding further rightward than I would have even been normally. People aren't stupid. They have been bombarded with some of the most sophisticated propaganda ever designed on multiple platforms on a mass scale.
Right. Which is absolutely true. And then when you couple that with the vacuum created by, the left-wing folks leaving, it's a double whammy, And I feel like one of the reasons that, I'm actually glad we've spent so much time focusing on this rural issue here today in regards to this change in Fascism Friday is that this is going to rear its head big time starting in about a year, right? When things start building up for the 2022 election, there is going to be an enormous push for the Republicans to take back Congress. And most of that effort is going to hinge on rural America. And so I think it's very important for us to understand this phenomenon of fascism coming from these abandoned areas in society. And how we need to, in whatever ways we can, connect with and support people who are in these places. And, every time somebody like Hillary Clinton gets up and says, these are the deplorables, you probably drop 3 or 4 congressional seats right there. And so we got to stop doing that. And we have to start figuring out how can we also support policies that reinvigorate these areas so that all kinds of people would like to move there and be there. And, so for example, making internet a public utility and making internet available everywhere would have a transformative effect on all of these issues.
Especially post-pandemic, when we've learned that a lot of worker base can be working from home. So if you had high-speed internet, and then there's a lot of, you hear about this all the time, small towns that are offering
free land
grants for homeownership, tax free basis for companies.
Yeah, right. Right down the road here in one of the small towns in Northwest Minnesota, you can get a free piece of land to build on, but you can't get internet. So why would the modern person build there?
So this lack, we're way past time, but
yeah.
A lot of interconnecting issues and lots of great comments conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much, everybody. Really good comments as always. Appreciate all of you. Appreciate your attention. Mm-hmm. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week, everybody.
For something.